It's a great day to be alive, and welcome to this week's version of The Hours. I'm Tyler, joined by Mark. We are Savvy Coaching, and we're going to dive right in to the big question. Mark, what is the worst athletic injury that you personally experienced in your own athletic career?
I broke my ankle several times. I think I broke my right one twice and my left one once.
How long were you out with those injuries?
At least 6 weeks.
During those 6 weeks, what were some of the things that you felt? Yeah, what was your emotional state?
You know, I don't really remember. The only thing I really remember is playing a whole lot of video games, which was probably not a good thing to be doing at that time.
I mean, injuries are a massive aspect of athletics, and we spend so much time as coaches planning, preparing systems, developing players for a moment of an injury to completely change and derail all of our best laid plans. And the emotional impact of that, both for players, but also for a coach. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, how's your season, coach? Injuries, right? I mean, it can become the focal point of an entire season. And what can you do to actually prepare and hopefully preempt injuries that could derail your season? Hopefully we can offer a couple of ideas around that, because I think it's something that is underutilized is injury prevention. And yet it's probably one of the greatest obstacles or challenges you might run into in your season. I have a pretty unique experience as an athlete. So having played through high school, college, and professionally, I never missed a single game due to injury, which I think is an absolute anomaly. I did have injuries and kind of bumps and played through a good amount, but I'm very, very blessed not to have ever had a major injury. My biggest injury, I mean, most of them actually happened in the off season, like a concussion, broken nose, but it was in the off season, didn't cause me to miss any games, broke my nose 5 times and played with masks multiple times in my career, but didn't actually have to miss a game. Cracked a rib in senior year of college in playoffs before we went to nationals, was able to continue to play through nationals, not very well, turned into a spot up shooter. But yeah, that's pretty rare. So thought I'd share that as well. So, you know, shout out to mom and dad for good genes.
You know, an injury that still lingers with me today is a dislocated pinky, believe it or not. That has really been, of all the bones that I've broken, if I could take one back, it would be the dislocated pinky. Dove on the floor.
Wait, it just pops out of place while you're typing or what?
Well, not anymore. It's just, I didn't really take care of it great. So it's just, it's not as mobile as it once was. But dove on the floor, smack my hand on the ground, pinky pops out. And without even thinking, I just touch it and it pops right back in. I'm like, all right, I think I'm good. And I put my hand on my knees to like bend over and like catch my breath, and it popped right back out. And I was like, oop, I'm done. I'm out.
Man, that pinky, who knew? Who knew? I know. You should just cut it off.
It's debatable whether we need it. Yeah.
We're talking about memorable finger injuries. I'll go quick. Maybe someone will find this interesting. If not, I apologize if this is really bad content. So my dad's a professional golfer. I was caddying for him in a tournament, I believe it was the Oregon Open years ago. And we were actually playing pool basketball before the first day of the tournament. Everyone's played some pool basketball. Things get pretty rugged. I was probably in high school, so my dad was still very physical with me. And we dislocated his ring finger battling over a ball in pool basketball the day before a major tournament. So he's just, you know, beside himself, upset. He's feeling he might have to withdraw because he couldn't even grip a club. It was that like swollen up and painful. And so he actually like did a grip where his ring finger and pinky were like off the club, and he had to like interlock, and like he was wincing through every swing. And crazily enough, he went on to actually win this tournament, the Oregon Open, with a dislocated index finger or ring finger, sorry. And I think, you know, that is an interesting thing about, like, you think about Jordan's flu game. You think there's many really powerful stories about people that, you know, push through injury in order to have epic performances, because there is something about an injury that laser focuses the mind. And I think it can go both ways. And I think that's a great segue into like, how do you prepare and preempt injury? My greatest answer is you can do some things to prepare and hopefully reduce your risks of injury as a team and a player and a coach and an athlete, but injuries are still inevitable. They are going to happen. So what's your plan, either as an individual athlete or as a coach, leader, and mentor, in order to use that injury as an opportunity? As I believe adversity strengthens, I believe that can be true for injuries as well. What's your injury plan for after they're injured to keep them engaged, to make it a learning experience to get the most out of it, to prepare the team and the team's mindset. Because so many times I think we're just caught by surprise, like, oh, Mark's injured. Now what do we do? And anytime we react to a negative situation, that reaction is probably going to be worse than if we had a prepared response. And so what's your injury prepared response? What's your injury plan? You know, even like, I just think about how calming that would be to a player. They get injured, they're down, they're depressed. Don't worry, I've got your next 2 weeks figured out with our injury response plan. Right? My wife's been going through some health challenges. And the thing that's most stressful is when there's no plan. There's no plan for recovery. And that's kind of what we've been going through. You know, but the moment some doctor says, don't worry, I have a plan. It might not even be a good plan. It might not even work. But we're like, we have a plan. And it calms us and makes us feel more confident for some reason. How many coaches do you think have an injury response plan prepared in their coaching book or coaching portfolio?
I'd say very few. And very few. Yeah, and it's I guess that's eye-opening because injuries are part of the game. Like you talked about, it's just they're inevitable. And I've always encouraged coaches to not fear injuries. I mean, you almost have to embrace it. Like, a lot of coaches will not compete later in the season because they're worried about injuries. Do we want to scale back competing? Yes, but not because we're scared of injuries. It's because we're cognizant of load and how that could potentially affect to prevent injuries on the court.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking in the interviews that I've been a part of interviewing or on a board. What's your response when they go 2-3 zone? They get up there on the board, right? What's your response? You know, when you're up at the end of the game, they get up there on the. What's your response for when you have an injury? That would freeze some coaches for sure. So, if nothing else, hopefully we can give you three actionable ways that you can begin to develop your own injury response plan, so you have it as a part of your coaching toolbox. What would be one thing a coach could utilize to start building their injury response plan?
Well, first, I would communicate the difference between hurt and injured in my players. Everybody is going to be hurt at some point in the season, but we're not all going to be injured. So I think educating your players and your parents first and foremost on that is the conversation before the conversation. So if I tweak my ankle, or like you said, like you broke a rib or did something to your rib, you were hurt, potentially injured, but it's something that you could play through. So that would be the first thing. And then my first step, I was just jotting down some ideas of what we would do whenever one of our players got injured. First thing, I wanted to call the parents. And one, out of a place of concern, I think that means a lot. Instead of your player getting in the car, going home, or they get home, it's like, hey, how was practice? Oh, I rolled my ankle, or I got hurt and I couldn't practice today. So reach out to the parents, but also that can help formulate the plan going forward. I always wanted our athletes to see our athletic trainer before they went and saw a doctor, because one, we can get you into the doctor faster. Two, we can get you the right doctor. And three, we can get you in a doctor that is more experienced with sports related injuries. And they know how important it is to get back on the floor. You know, general practitioner might say, oh, well, you know, sit out for 2 weeks. And in that 2 weeks, we might miss, you know, four games and six practices where another doctor could have got us in sooner.
Beautiful. Okay. I'm going to flip the side of it. How can you prevent more injuries? So a really interesting study was done a few years ago. It was actually primarily around Andre Iguodala. So it was back when he was playing at the Golden State Warriors. I think we're probably 3 or 4 years removed from that now, which is crazy. And this entire study was centered around sleep and rest. The impact of the number of hours of sleep that he got per night on his actual performance. So his field goal percentage and his turnover rate were two that really stuck out. Like, if he got under 8 hours of sleep, his field goal percentage plummeted. It was down to like 32%. His turnovers skyrocketed. Whereas if he got over 9 hours of sleep, the reverse happened. His field goal percentage was quite high and his turnover rate was quite low. Well, there was another aspect of this as well. They were able to associate that with the number of hours of sleep over, you know, a 2 week period, the risk of injury was drastically reduced with more hours of sleep. In fact, what they proposed at the end of this study was that the greatest factor for injury prevention was sleep. Now, if you think about, many of our listeners are high school coaches. If you think about high school students and athletes, they are not prioritizing their rest. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a graph on the left side or the y-axis. You have the likelihood of injuries, And on the x-axis, the horizontal axis, you have average hours of sleep per night. If you average 5 hours of sleep, there's a 60% likelihood of an injury. Interestingly enough, 6 hours of sleep has more, 75%. And then you have, it starts to decrease when you go to 7 hours, 8 hours, and at 9 hours of sleep, it is less than 20% likelihood of being injured. I also saw something with Texas Tech basketball, men's basketball, a few years ago. It's a good tweet. It talked about how they all committed to getting an extra hour or two of sleep, and not only did their injuries go down, but their free throw percentage went up. A lot of other statistics went up, and not, you know, you're not going to see a drastic, like, huge change across the board, but it was, you know, free throw percentage up 6 percentage points, field goal percentage up 5 percentage points. And if you add all that up, it's such a tremendous advantage. And actually, we just took all of our paid members through a 4-week cohort, and we would a deep dive on how to make your team better right now. And this would be something that I would look at. Week 3, we talked about marginal gains. Getting more sleep is absolutely one way where you can gain an advantage over all of your opponents. Tyler, you were saying something about a high school coach listening right now.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about standards all the time. So we'll take you through kind of our framework, right? So you establish the vision for your program. And in order to achieve this vision, what are the standards? That'd be your second step. What are the standards that must be upheld? A standard of a program should be how much sleep your athletes are getting every single night. That's just a standard. I mean, if you have a standard around the timeliness at which they show up to practice, you must also have a standard around how they prepare their bodies. And, you know, so often we focus all of our standards on the 2 hours we get to spend with them during the day around practice. Like, all the standards are compressed into this 2 hours, but everything that happens in that 24-hour period impacts their performance and contributions to your team and your program. And so when creating your standards, do not forget to establish standards around their entire life, because how you do anything is how you'll do everything. So how a player approaches their sleep will impact how they approach their, you know, toughness on rebounding or their effort level in bolting out. And so standards as a second step of building a successful program, I think, must include something around sleep. And really think about your standards and how you would establish those around things outside of practice. Let me give the other two, Mark. I know you have something to add around standards real quick. So then your standards are then going to determine what your culture actually is. Culture is in the conversations of accountability around your standards, right? And then your culture builds the identity. That's the 4 steps of building a program. Vision informs your standards. Your standards then inform your culture. And then your culture over time, when it internalizes and becomes like breathing, that's when you have an identity. So we do a deep dive into standards in one of our cohorts every single year. We take our paid community through deep dives every single month, which we call cohorts. We go through it together as a cohort so that we can improve and grow in some aspect of coaching and leadership. Standards is one that we generally do leading up to the season, usually in late summer or early fall. Okay, I know you want to talk about standards outside of practice, Mark, or something along those lines.
Yeah,
read it in your eyes.
I got a lot, you know, when you talked about injuries, I got a lot more than I thought I would. A lot of stuff, right? That you're saying is resonating with me. So you talked about just standards outside of the 2 hours that we have our athletes in practice. And to me, that is the biggest difference between coaching a team and building a program or leading a program. Is like you're talking about, like, your culture, you get that flywheel effect where it's like, that's us. And you know you've arrived whenever someone's below standard, and everybody's response, not just yours, is, oh man, that's not us. Like, that's not how we do it, right? When we get hurt, we go see the trainer. We don't skip, you know, like, our guys would always go see the trainer at lunch after they ate. That was standard, right? That was part of our culture. We like to make our things as sticky as possible, whether it's on the court or off the court. So one of our standards, we're rested and ready. Rested was, we're committing to getting 8 hours of sleep. Anything below would be below standard. Did we always get that? No. Did we average that? I hope so. And part of that was, you know, unplugging from technology certain amount of time beforehand. And then ready, we've defined readiness as motivation to attend to a task. How motivated am I to do the next thing right? Whether that's homework or getting to the practice or my effort in practice. If you don't sleep, it's very hard to be ready to do the next task. And I'll give some other ideas here around or outside of sleep that happen outside of your practice as well. One, I would encourage coaches to lift. Really dedicate your off season around lifting. That is when you can get the most out of your athletes as far as your strength and conditioning program. But I would also implore you to lift during the season. One of the best ways to stay injury free, that is prehab. We want to be proactive in everything. And when you lift, you're building body armor. A lot of times injuries come, especially the soft tissue injuries come from fatigue or lack of core strength. Like an ACL injury might come because like I can't get my core rigid and stop on a dime. When I stop, my knee keeps going. So that's really important. Rehabbing whenever you are hurt, and then active recovery too. Day after a game, I think your warm-up can look a little different. It could be some band stuff, some rollout. If you have an athletic trainer or strength and conditioning coach, you're well ahead of the game. I would suggest that you utilize them and try to be on the cutting edge and proactive, especially as we're getting right now, we're heading into February here. So it becomes more and more important at this point in the season.
Let me summarize this. One, most important thing, establish standards around all 24 hours in the day if you want to build a special program. If you want to check yourself to see if you're building a program or coaching a team, just ask yourself, Mark made a great point. Have you established standards outside of the 2 hours you have them, whether that be once a week for like a youth or club team, or whether it be five times a week or six times a week for a higher level team? That is a great test. Second, in order to preempt or prevent injuries, three things to establish standards around: sleep, eat, lift. Standards around sleep, standards around nutrition, and standards around lifting. That would be your prehab and recovery, everything. Sleep, eat, lift. Do you have standards? And then lastly, I want to repeat what you said, Mark, and I think you said this. Attention is motivation to attend a task. That was just beautiful, and I didn't quite catch it.
Readiness, the definition of readiness is motivation to attend to a task.
That concept would be a standard, an example of a standard. Okay, we have a standard of readiness. Are we above or below this? Do we have the motivation or the attention to attend to a task right now? We're below standard. We then need to get above that standard. And so, you know, as you're building your standards, start by stealing. And that would be a great one to steal. Let's do a real quick mailbag. I've got one for you. This one just actually came in as a DM, a reminder for everyone that's in our free community. Over 2,000 coaches in our free community. As you have questions, three steps. All right. Okay. Step one, search to see if that question has been asked before so you can join an existing conversation. Two, post your question publicly as opposed to a private message, because that's what a community is we want to learn together, right? Three, engage. We have over 2,000 coaches in our free community. And I mean, I could pull up the exact numbers, but a smaller percentage than the 2,000 are the most active engaged. But everyone's just in there reading and consuming. Don't be a consumer. A community grows when you interact and engage. So if you've gotten any value from this free community that we're building for you, give the value back. Don't just keep the gift for yourself. Pass it on. So search, right? Ask it publicly and then engage. Even if you just say, thank you so much for your answer. Make the effort to engage. It's really, really powerful. Coach, we are playing a kid that's gone off for 35 plus multiple times a season. I'm searching for ideas about how to defend a great player. Struggling to find the right words in the search bar. I can't find anything. How do you guard a great player? Mark, what would your approach be if you're guarding this great player?
You know, what comes to mind is something that I stole from you and that I've given advice many times since you shared this with me. And I probably always had this thought process, but never articulated it this way, is just try to get them into the least efficient part of their game. If it's a dominant player, we're not going to shut them out, but what are we willing to live with? You know, maybe it's they can shoot the three, but they really like to get to the rack. Then how can we bait them? How can we game plan to getting them to shoot more threes than twos?
Beautiful. I won't even say, okay, we'll say a little more about that. that was the approach that Shane Battier took when he was with the Houston Rockets when they played the Los Angeles Lakers against Kobe Bryant in the Western Conference playoffs years and years ago. And he actually divulged that. He's like, Kobe's going to get his 30 points, but can we have him do it in a less efficient way? And what they determined was Kobe's least efficient shot that he was very enthusiastic about taking was a mid-range pull-up jumper going to his left hand. When Kobe went right, he went all the way to the rim. He was way more efficient. When he went left, he pulled up way less efficient, didn't draw fouls, et cetera, et cetera. So bait him into shooting pull-up jumpers going left. So I just wanted to give a real-life example. There were actually a bunch of articles written about it. You could look it up. Okay, here's a second thing I would say when playing a great player. Don't give him too much respect. And it's actually connected to the first one. When you give a great player just like one-on-one defensively, when you give them too much respect, you're playing on your heels, you're giving them space to breathe, you're afraid of getting beat, and you allow that player to set up their favorite move or the opposite of what we just talked about, what they're most efficient at. Even great players don't like to be pressured, bothered, get into their body. I'll give a real specific example of this. My younger brother, 6'8", lefty, hyper athletic, really, really good shooter, dominant player. And when he was given space in college, he was able to straight line drive left, really, really strong, able to go into this little jab jumper, which he shot incredibly efficiently. And he was able to do his thing. And when he, as a 6'8 player, when he was guarded by other taller players, 6'7", 6'6", whatever, they tended to not be as quick or as physical. They would give him a little bit more space and he would be able to cook and do his thing. He had the most trouble with these little 6'2 bulldog type defenders. They would get up under him and get up into his space, and they would steal his vision and force him into like getting really angry and frustrated, and we'd do really inefficient things. The little players that didn't give him any respect as a superstar caused him the most problems, right? The players that backed off and gave him respect, like, oh, he has so many moves, he's really explosive, he would cook. It's the same for nearly every single player. Don't give them too much respect. So when you're thinking about, who do I want to defend this player? Well, you want to put a defender in that just has the audacity to disrespect a star. And especially over the course of time, if they're picking them up across half court, guarding them, you know, 94 feet, that's where you're going to have a little bit more success either way.
It reminds me of a good quote that I heard recently. It's like, what if we played offense when we were on defense? Take that approach against the stars. All right, here's one for you, Tyler. This is coming from a member in our paid community, and his team is struggling with, it sounds like, confidence. He wants to some tips with overcoming the mental and psychological aspect of the game. He feels like his team's going to games scared because the other team's going to press. If they have an open shot, he thinks their mental process is, oh, I hope I don't miss this, or I can't miss this shot, or we'll lose, or I'll come out of the game. So what are some tips to help this coach overcome that part of the game?
Step one, measurement is magic. I would ask that coach and every coach, what is your ratio? Like, actually measure. What's your ratio of correction to praise of your team in practice, of your team in games? What's your ratio of correction to praise? Even though we think correction is welcomed, correction still does come off as you did this wrong, whether it actually cognitively hear it that way, or it just subconsciously goes into their mind that way. So what's your ratio? If you want a more confident team, get to 6-1. Get to 6 positive praise to every 1 correction. And I would guarantee, I would bet a lot of money, I wouldn't guarantee, but I would bet a lot of money that this particular coach, who I don't know who it is, that if we actually measured their ratio of correction to praise, everything they said to their team is not at 6-1 positive to correction. Mark, how much money, real money, if this was a real bet and we could know, would you bet that this coach is not at 6-1?
No offense to this coach, because I would take this bet on everybody that is ever coaching. I would bet all of my money, sir.
It's true, right? All of the money.
Yeah.
All of the money. And exactly how much money is that? No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so I would bet, I would too. I feel like I would bet all of my money on every coach that we are not at 6-1.
Yeah. And look, because it's not easy, right? You have to be very intentional, and you have to train yourself just like you got to train your players to do something. You have to make that a habit. Yeah.
Mark, were you at 6-1?
No. No. Right.
Neither am I.
I would say, man, I probably had to work really hard to get like 2-1. Because I was probably 1-6 early in my coaching career. Cause when something good happened, it's like, yeah, that's what it's supposed to look like. When something bad happens, like, how dare you, you know?
And to connect this back for all of us as coaches, like Mark and I are here telling you get to 6-1. Mark and I are here saying we didn't and we don't. But that's what's beautiful about standards and what's honestly beautiful about what we're trying to build at Savvy is a savvy coach is comfortable in the tension of not being where they want to be yet, but committed to movement. That's really what a savvy coach is. You know, it's one aspect of what a savvy coach is. And so if you're here, you're that type of person. And thank you for being here. Like, you're not satisfied with where you are, right? You recognize that you need to grow and you're committed to actually move in that direction. So that's what a standard is. That's what we were talking about standards earlier, right? A standard of our program is every player gets 9 hours of sleep every single night. That's a standard. Most players, most of the time, will fall short. But are your players willing to actually look that in the eye and recognize that they are falling short? And are they committed to movement? It's the same for in every aspect, right? So this would be another standard, like just establish one, really measure it, recognize where we're falling short, and let's commit to movement on it. And it will help your team get more confident. Okay, here's the second tip that I would give for this coach or any coach that wants a team to get more confident. There's two sides to every coin. At Savvy, we believe that basketball is a game of opposites, right? So if we want something on offense, we want to take that away on defense, right? Same thing for confidence. A 6-1 ratio by what we speak into them will grow their confidence. But there's another way that we can reduce their fear and doubt. That's the opposite side of the coin. And a lot of times we're like, man, I want more confident players. I have to pour in confidence. Well, lack of confidence comes from caring a lot about other people's opinions. And so a way that you can also grow confidence is by trying to get them to care less. And that's really just like a heart state in every other aspect of modern day life is building the opinion of others into how people see themselves. And I think that the most confident people didn't necessarily have more self-belief, maybe a little bit more, but the thing that was really stood out to me about the most confident people I've ever been around is how little the opinion of others mattered to them. And so getting a player to care less about the miss, getting a player to care less about the turnover, getting people to care less about the opinions of others is a key thing. I mean, I'll give a very silly maybe example, but it's where I'm at in coaching right now is I'm coaching my daughter's 4th and 5th grade team. And very often in these tournaments that we play, these AAU tournaments, we're the only girls team in the age division. There's not a lot of girls team at this level. And so we were playing as the only girls team in an AAU tournament. And we beat this boys team that hadn't lost. And like the boys team was just livid. So they go in the back end of the draw and we play them again in the championship the next day. And prior to the championship, this boys team is like right next to our girls team. And they're like talking trash and like, you know, slitting their throat at them. Like, right. And so like our girls are getting very flustered and agitated, like, oh, they're going to foul us. And they're coming for blood because it was a very close game in the first game, right? And so they're getting very, very agitated. And so instead of me taking the approach when I gathered them up and saying, you got this, you're strong, you won the game before, you're really good, like building their confidence, I instead chose to take the approach and I just built around this. I said, have you guys ever heard the expression that lions don't concern themselves with the opinions of sheep? Right. And the girl's like, no, we've never heard that before. Never heard that before. I'm like, okay, well, let's unpack that a little bit. So we unpacked it. I'm like, if what they're doing is bothering you, you believe that they're not sheep. You believe that their opinion matters. I'm like, but you just need to actually care less about their opinions. And we went in and smashed them by like 15. And I don't think that it was because we focused on building up their confidence. I think we actually just suppressed their care for what these other boys thought of them in that moment, right? So that would just be an example, and another way to grow confidence is just get them to eliminate fear, other people's opinions, eliminate the FOPO.
Gosh, I have so many other things to add to that.
This always happens. Like we're here, we're like, okay, let's do a mailbag. Let's hit a lot of mailbag questions. We apologize. Yeah. But then whenever we hit one, it goes, so we apologize.
Yeah, I mean, we could start talking about NATO and all kinds of other things that we share with our savvy coaches. All right.
Let's go one more. This one is for you. Define what a second cut is and how one would train it.
A second cut, if I was explaining this to a five-year-old, I would say is a back cut, assuming they know what that is, right? A cut to the rim on a dribble stop. So typically you have cut first. Your cut might be a cut to the corner. Your cut could be lifting out of the corner to space the floor. And then as an offensive player gets to a dribble stop, you're now going to cut a second time. Usually that cut is to the basket. But simply put, it's a back cut from a dribble stop. The way I would train these would be, gosh, a game that I share a lot, and it has so much utility because you can use it for a lot of different things. I like to play 3-on-3, no help. So we're going to play 3-on-3. No one is allowed to help. So if we don't drive and get a 9, then we get a dribble stop, and then we're going to be overplayed, denied. So it's going to open up opportunities for second cuts. That would be the easiest application to get a second cut live, because here was always my frustration in practice is you were trying to train something and it didn't happen in the game or the drill. So you might practice or introduce second cuts and then go play 4-on-4 and there's just no opportunities to second cut. So a good coach would shape that environment. I think a great way to do that is to eliminate help defense.
Should my team master first cuts before we even teach second cuts?
Absolutely, I would say, because we always, and it doesn't matter if it was second cuts or two outs or protection plans, we always start from spacing because that is a first principle, right? Like, do we arrive spaced and organized? Can we maintain spacing in the half court? If you can't do those, then I would say even if your team is second cutting, it's going to be really hard to take advantage of that because we're not properly spaced. So defense is going to be crowding the paint, or you just don't understand spacing in general, or when to cut to the rim is with advantage. When do I have an advantage? When I'm overplayed or defense can't see me, which would be more of a burn cut. So I would teach those two principles before I would even get to second cutting.
Yeah. For those of you that are running the race in space or drive in space offense, in race in space, the first cut is layer two, right? Layer one is how do we actually quickly get from defense to offense? That's layer one, right? Race the arcs. Layer two, the very next thing you should teach, we call it space and hunt. And the spacing aspect is our first cutting. And so the way that we develop race and space is chronologically both how it should happen in a possession, but also how you should teach it to any team. And so a first cut is the second thing that you should teach, or the first thing that I think you should teach a team is how do we quickly, with pace, race the arcs and arrive in dominoes or with advantage. And so if you want to check that out more, just join our free community. There's a bunch of comments in there about the race and space offense. You can also purchase the race and space course, which is where I would start with every single team before you go a little bit deeper into something like drive in space or any other sort of a half court system. I think you need to establish principles of play, and that's what race in space does. Or you can just join our paid community, get access to all of our classroom, get access to all of our cohort deep dives, get access to our exclusive community of savvy coaches that have been doing it for years, as well as video and film breakdown. There's links to both of those below. We love working with our coaches. All right, Mark, you want to take us through a game of the week? And I think it's around KOs.
Yeah, so a KO would be a game ender. It is a knockout punch. So this could be in 1-on-1, 2-on-2. I love it in a 5-on-5 setting because it's a great way to direct your team's focus to a specific concept or action. We could use KO as our KO could be a second cut, which what is our players going to think about now is on a dribble stop, I'm hunting a second cut. So the question that prompted this in our community was, what are some ideas for KO? So I thought it was important that we talk through what KO is. And again, that is a knockout punch that ends the game. If we're playing 5-on-5 to 5, but we score on the KO action, well, that's just a 5-point bucket, or that is just the game winner. Whatever your score is, it automatically gets you to 5. And there's all kind of fun things you can do, validate with a free throw or validate another way. Question was, what are some ideas for some more KOs? So Tyler, let's just popcorn a few. I will start. I won't take the easy one in second cut. I'll go another one. A 2-out 7 would be a fun KO for teams to train ball movement and hunting better shots.
That is my absolute favorite one. And I call it a click, click, boom, or a 2-out 7, the boom being the 7, because all of our players love to scream boom when one goes in. Okay, I'm going to go one, scoring off of a specific action. Like, let's say we just implemented Spain action. Yeah, we're playing. If you score off Spain action, any score, KO.
I'll go burn cut. Not only is it going to get your team burn cutting, but also like about this is it's going to make your players attack with vision, because they're going to want to play with vision so they can hit the burn cut.
An eight being off of 2 feet, powerful, foul drawn at the rim, that is going to be a KO. Just to get them to initiate contact more.
I like that because it's also going to train defense to not foul whenever they give up dribble penetration. Good, love it. Okay, KO for me would be a bomb in transition. So a bomb would be we get behind the defense, we pitch the ball ahead for a 9 in transition.
Beautiful. Here's another one that I like, an offensive rebound 7. So anytime we get an offensive rebound and you immediately kick it out for a 7 that goes in, it's a KO. I think that focuses on rebounding, but also so many times in offensive rebounds, they lead to 5s. Like you get an offensive rebound, they put up something really highly contested. Like I got an offensive rebound, I'm close to the rim, I should shoot it. But I love the offensive rebound, immediate space in kick out 7.
All right, KO for me, you've already said action, so I will say, a Barkley, like a protection plan. So a specific protection plan that you want to train, be stride stop, could be back pivot, we call it a donut. But yeah, I'll go protection plan or more specifically a Barkley.
Cool, I'll switch intangible. Anytime after a score where the scorer loudly thanks the passer, KO. So thanking the passer after a score could be a KO as well.
Let's go defense. I will say sniping a pass would be a KO.
Yep, beautiful. I'll stay defense as well. And I'll go anytime you get the ball to jail on a dribble pickup, KO. So you get them to dribble to jail and they pick up the ball in jail, then we'll call that a KO. Last one that I'm gonna do is, I don't love charge taking, but I love the excitement people have when they take a charge. So that would be another one that I would use, is take a charge on defense. It's just a KO. And I like the benefits of charge taking. I don't like the actual act of taking the charge. The benefits of charge taking is you have to move your body defensively, both on ball and off ball, early and with a lot of effort. And you have to get your body on the drive line, which is what we want to do, regardless if we're taking a charge or not. So I like the benefits of charge taking. So a charge KO, and you know, I've done this a lot, is just, that's just a default KO in every game we play for the entire season, right? Take a charge, it's going to be a KO. And I think it happens with the right amount of frequency for that.
Yeah, I was watching Ole Miss in Texas last night, and an Ole Miss player slid under. Might have been the other way. Texas player slid under Ole Miss player driving to the basket. Both players got hurt. It's like, come on.
Yeah. And I guess for those of you listening, that's why I don't love the act of charge taking, is just from an injury standpoint and how it's like often a dangerous play, unfortunately.
Yeah. So how to prevent injuries? Don't slide under people.
Don't do charges as KOs.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said a charge is a result of just doing your work early. Like you said, like, I'm going to get here, I'm going to show my chest to the ball. If they keep going, this means I'm taking a charge. If they pass, great job, mission accomplished.
As opposed to flinging your body, you know, at the last second under a driver. You didn't do your work early. That's fake hustle.
It means you were late. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go teach better. As a teacher of basketball or a coach of basketball, your response is way more important than your reaction. In fact, I would encourage you to respond instead of react. So just like Tyler talked about, what's our response system to injuries? I would have a response system to good plays and negative plays in practice. If we're constantly reacting, then your players are going to be scared to miss that shot. They're going to be scared to make a mistake. They're going to be scared that the other team's going to press, because our coach talks about, you know, freaks out when we turn the ball over against pressure in practice. So here's a actionable tip on how to be a better responder instead of a better reactor. And if you're watching on YouTube, I have a list up here that I used in practice. In our best practices, our coaching staff would huddle before practice and we would pick one of these areas to focus on. If you're not watching on YouTube, I'll read a few examples. Asking lots of questions, injecting some humor or laughter in the practice, short energetic exchanges, no long speeches, physical touch, eye contact, all those things. I felt like when I was focused on one of these, it made me a much better teacher and a much better responder, because if somebody made a mistake and my goal was to have great eye contact this practice, my focus went to just connect with this player, like just make eye contact. And then my response was so much better. If you join our community, I'll make a post on this so you can have a copy of this picture. And I'll talk a little bit about how to rate yourself and an activity you can do around your coaching staff. But teach better is be a better responder instead of only focusing on your reaction.
That is excellent. All right, Mark, last question. In what aspect of your life are you the worst responder? In which aspect of your life are you the best responder? Outside of coaching, just everything right now.
I am the worst responder when I have to tell my daughter something more than one time. Or actually, you know, it's more of I react to their response. So that's my worst one. If I ask them to do something that I think is pretty normal, on standard, on par with what we should do, and they respond in a negative way, I've got to be really intentional about how I respond. Too many times I react. The best way, I think, is I'm gonna be around my daughters too. I guess parenting is so important. When they say something that I don't agree with, whether it's around something that happened at school or why do we do this, why do we do that, my response has been, you know, now it's been okay, and it gives me a little bit to kind of think about why they would think that way, and then usually some advice may ensue. What about you?
I'll go worst first as well. And I was thinking about all the specific times that I respond poorly. And at first they seemed unrelated, but then I recognized I am my worst responder when I am feeling overwhelmed or unprepared. So a lot of things are hitting at once. I have to leave the house for an appointment and I don't have my bag packed, or I'm missing an important power cord or whatever. And I just start like stomping around the house, throwing a temper tantrum. Who took my bag? Who took my shoes? Because I'm overwhelmed and unprepared. And as I speak that, I think of so many applications in coaching there, is you respond worst when you're overwhelmed or unprepared. Key. I respond best when I'm in a emotional or chemical state of confidence and happiness. Like when I feel like I've done my morning routine, I've worked out, I feel like everything is planned out and in order. It doesn't matter what comes my way. When I've filled my own cup, when I've taken care of my own energy and health, I respond really, really well. And in reality, the world and the universe hasn't changed at all in those two scenarios. Everything that's changed is like just between my own ears. And I think that, you know, what we'll leave with that is like, as a savvy coach, like control the space between your own ears. Control that first. Get yourself to a state where you're prepared and where you've energized yourself. And then I think your response will be much more savvy.
Yeah, be rested and ready.
Rested, ready. Sleep, eat, and lift, and you'll probably have a better response in every aspect of your life.
No doubt. Keep you healthy too.
Yep. In the month of February, we are going to deep dive. We're going to take a cohort through winning at the right time. Most of you are coming to winning time in your season, playoffs, championship time, the most important games of your season. So we want to support you and help you win more possessions. We want to help you be prepared for in-game situations. We want to help you tweak your practices, because your end of season practices should look different than your beginning season practices. So we want to help you win at the right time. That is going to be our focus of our live training every single week with our savvy coaches. Well, thank you for joining us. Who would have thought that injuries would lead to confidence, which would lead to KOs, which would lead to establishing standards. But that's what we do on the hours. So thank you for spending the hour with us. I'm Tyler. This is Mark. We are Savvy Coaching. Until next time.
Stay savvy.
Stay savvy.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.